I'm Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to the Eva Herr Show this week. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Tonight we have Guido Massey, and we're going to talk about his book, The Wild Medicine Solution. But I've asked Guido to talk about what he would do as an herbalist, in particular cases of particular ailments with herbs. Understand that we are not attempting to treat or diagnose you, and that you must work with your own personal doctor, that all we're doing is providing information. So thank you for being with us, Guido. And before we get started in your interview, please tell us where people can find your book, The Wild Medicine Solution, and any others that you might have, and how they might reach you if they'd like to make an appointment with you.
Yeah, so thanks, first of all, Eva, for having me again on the show. It's nice to be here, and I hope you had a great weekend and a great Independence Day.
It was a good one.
Nice to wind this weekend down. But I work at this nonprofit that I helped start. I'm one of the co-directors there. It's called the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism, and the website is vtherbcenter.org, and you can get in touch with me through there, or you can get in touch with my office for an appointment or just to learn more about what we do. I'm also the chief herbalist for an extract company called Urban Moonshine, and that's urban, like U-R-B-A-N, moonshine.com. My 16-week Urban Moonshine Herb School program, which is an online course, is available there. And just, you know, it's a neat company. We focus on bringing some of the most useful herbs to folks for some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight, some of these most common complaints that we see as part of the Western culture. You can get my book, The Wild Medicine Solution, on Amazon through indiebound.org, which can also refer you to a local bookstore. Many local bookstores carry it. And if you're interested in what I have to say, The Wild Medicine Solution does summarize that a little bit. And, of course, I'd appreciate you checking it out. But I really just appreciate you getting to know some of these wild medicinal plants, some of which are probably growing in your backyard, which can be really useful for a lot of the most common complaints that bug people.
So let's assume that everyone that's listening has a personal physician, and that personal physician said to the person, you have this particular illness, and the illnesses that come to the top of my mind, but you can talk about anything that you want. Early detection and prevention is just where my focus is. But let's say liver problems, or that they have gallbladder issues or fatty liver, or if they have a weak heart, you know, like we talked about before, or how do you keep your kidneys strong? How do you keep your gut healthy? How do you keep your teeth or gums? Diabetes, anything that you can tell us, how would we detect it to begin with? Because everybody has their own particular way of detecting things, every field of medicine. And once we find out we have something, from your perspective in herbal medicine, what would you do? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, so it does. And I would say that, first of all, you know, as an herbalist, I work in partnership with physicians, and it's really great to work with some of these folks in Montpelier and in Burlington here in Vermont, because they have good personal relationships with their patients, and then they are, I would say, wise enough to be able to recognize how important nutrition and herbal medicine can be in making sure that some of these problems that are detected early can be addressed early through these very simple and basically side effect free herbal and nutritional support strategies, which is one of the great advantages of using herbal medicine as opposed to, say, you know, a blood pressure drug at the early stages of pre-hypertension. But to kind of recap or summarize some of the most important areas that I run into and that physicians ask for support for their patients, you know, the number one killer of Americans these days is cardiovascular disease. So that's certainly a big one. And cardiovascular disease means, you know, a problem with your heart or your blood vessels or sometimes both. And it can lead to issues such as heart attack or stroke, or even contribute to things like chest pain, angina, or valvular defects like a mitral valve prolapse, heart rhythm abnormalities and arrhythmia like an atrial fibrillation, and even things like dementia. If there is a lot of blockage in the vessels that bring blood to the brain, people can have issues with cognitive function and performance and memory and all that sort of stuff. It also dovetails with things like erectile dysfunction and good sexual function. You know, a good strong heart and good circulation are really important for all of those things. So that's kind of one area I want to talk about in terms of early detection, and also in terms of support from an herbal and nutritional perspective. The other thing that's huge... Another thing that's huge is, as you mentioned, our relationship to sugar and particularly how our body processes sugar. Hyper and hypoglycemia, blood sugar that is too high, blood sugar that is too low. And actually, these are both kind of two sides of the same coin and can be connected to pre-diabetes or even frank overt diabetes. That's another big thing that folks come to me with a diagnosis of diabetes, looking for support from an herbal perspective, and another really important consideration in modern medicine and in the Western population. And then other things that are important from a physiologic perspective are, as you mentioned, the function of the digestion in the liver. Because in this department, you know, if the gut's off, if the mucous membrane of the GI tract, you know, the lining of our gut is inflamed or irritated, if the liver is not processing things well, or if it's getting inflamed to the point of developing a condition like fatty liver, which I think you mentioned, Eva, then you will see an increase in inflammation throughout the body. And this can be connected to allergies or food sensitivities, hypersensitivity in general. It can be connected, believe it or not, to inflammation in the blood vessels, which feeds back again to cardiovascular disease. And the last area where I am, where I do a lot of work in partnership with physicians, is in the area of mental health. And, you know, it's a little more difficult to kind of talk about early detection for mental health issues for something like insomnia. You know, you either have insomnia or you don't. But believe it or not, you can kind of see things sort of creeping in slowly before people get to the point of saying, well, I only got 3 hours of sleep last night, or I only got 3 hours of sleep every night this week, and I just feel totally wiped out. It takes a while to get to that point, and there are some things you can kind of try and watch out for in your life and in some of the symptoms that you might be experiencing. So I definitely, if I have time, like to talk about those three areas first: cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and blood sugar regulation, and the function of the digestion in the liver. But if I have a little time, I'd like to talk a little bit about supporting good mental health, too.
That would be fabulous. And if we have extra time, I wouldn't also mind you to talk about kidneys, because one thing I've realized with people that have MTHFR mutations, which, as you know, is a problem in this country today, is a lot of the people also have what go with that. I think it's either CBS or COMT gene, if I'm not mistaken, and everybody has weak kidneys, and then when they get, you know, 60, they start having kidney failure or thereabouts.
Yeah, early kidney failure can be a possibility.
What to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe I can just start by addressing that really quick before going into those other areas, but you know, it turns out that one of the best ways you can, you know, other than hydration and good overall hydration all the time, that you can keep your kidneys in good health is to eat a lot of leafy green vegetables. And it's for a couple of reasons. One is they contain a lot of naturally occurring potassium, which is very important for overall water balance in the system, and also good for the kidneys. But they also contain a couple of key substances. First of all, they're loaded with folate, and this means everything from something very simple like kale or, to a certain extent, chard and some of the other greens, but very specifically things like dandelion greens, which you don't normally see them a lot in the grocery store or on people's dinner plates, but, man, they're everywhere, and they're so good for the kidneys. A really classic traditional diuretic loaded with potassium and, crucially, loaded with folate. So in terms of the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase mutation that you alluded to and its potentially deleterious effect on the kidneys, supplementing with adequate bioavailable folate from green plants can be just a really ongoing, good preventive strategy. And what it also can help with is making sure that your blood doesn't get too thick or viscous, right? which can be one of the issues with MTHFR. And that can really provide a big burden to the kidneys if the blood is too thick and viscous and blood flow through the nephron is affected. So just a daily salad with dandelion greens and spinach and kale and chard and romaine lettuce and all of that good stuff is one important strategy. But the other thing that has received, I would say, the bulk of the attention from a research perspective in herbal medicine are herbs like astragalus, astragalus membranaceus, which is a very important sort of immunostimulating herb or immune-balancing herb, but also is a great kidney protector. And parsley family plants. That includes parsley itself, but also things like celery and celery seed, and very specifically the root of this parsley, Angelica sinensis, also known as dung quai. And dung quai has a very good protective and anti-inflammatory effect on the kidney, not only because of its mineral content, kind of like the dandelion leaf, and its folate content, but also because of the high bioflavonoid content, substances like epigenin, which tend to have a strong anti-inflammatory effect, particularly on the kidney tissue, and thereby helping to prevent the damage that could lead to kidney failure at age 60, like you mentioned. So
That's fabulous.
Sort of daily preventive strategies, dandelion leaf and parsley, they can be put into a green smoothie, or dung quai root powder can be added to a smoothie or to oatmeal or to any grain that you cook. And it tastes fine. It's not bitter or too strong or anything like that. And that daily maintenance, especially if you know you have this particular mutation and that could put your kidneys at risk, then adding that into your life on a daily basis can really help prolong the strength of that vitally important organ. Because, you're born with the kidneys you got. If they get inflamed and the nephrons get destroyed, you can't grow new ones. So protect what you have and try and forestall any damage.
So I have a question, a quick one, before we move on, if it's okay. What about in the South, I don't know about where you are, but in the South we're abundant in turnip greens and collards. Do those two greens do as good a job as astragalus and dandelion or not?
I would say they'd be more similar to dandelion. The astragalus root and the dung quai are very specific kidney anti-inflammatories, and I would consider adding those into your diet.
Okay.
Turnip greens and collard greens are great. They're definitely loaded in folate, so fantastic in that sense. With things like beet greens and in particular and chard, you want to be a little bit careful about the oxalate content, which can be bad for the kidneys if you're prone to kidney stones. But with collards, that's not at all as big of a concern. It's a broccoli family plant and actually functions as a really good folate donor and a really good methyl donor because of the isothiocyanates that are present in them. And in all broccoli family plants, like broccoli, kale, collards, that sort of stuff.
Gosh,
so if you got it, get it in your diet.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Go ahead then.
Those are great questions. Now, the first and sort of biggest killer in the Western culture and in the United States is cardiovascular disease. It's the number one killer of men, but also of postmenopausal women, and it's right up there in terms of lethality for women in general. So that's one of the places where, the docs will call and will say, I got this guy, he's got borderline high blood pressure, his blood pressure is, even above 140 systolic, and we should medicate him, but he really doesn't want to get medicated. Is there anything we can do from an herbal and nutritional perspective to help bring his blood pressure under control? And there are. There's great things, and I want to talk briefly about them. But in terms of early detection of cardiovascular disease, from an herbal perspective, it's really difficult to get a handle on whether someone has blood pressure that's elevated or not just by looking at them or asking them questions. So being able to get a blood pressure test is a really, I think, an important thing for folks. Oh, probably starting in their mid-20s, if you've never had one done, it's worth having that checked out. Now, there are some herbalists who look at people's constitutions or kind of states of being. So there are some constitutional issues that come up that might make me say, maybe I need to refer you to a physician if you haven't seen one recently to just have your blood pressure checked out and to make sure that everything is okay. And one of those is, what I call and what herbalists have called this pattern of trapped heat, right? And just to describe that really briefly, it's called trapped heat, okay? And let me explain what I mean by that. It's like there's this heat, but It's trapped in the core. It's trapped in the central part of the body, around the heart and the thorax, around the great vessels. And you might see a gentleman, and it often is gentlemen, but not always, who have, you know, a red face and a loud voice, and definitely, you know, they look really strong, but they have really thin legs and maybe thin arms as well, and cold hands and feet. So there's these signs of, you know, redness on, in the tongue and redness on the face and a booming voice and a lot of signs of sort of heat and intensity. But the periphery, the arms and the legs, the outer parts of the body are cold and not getting a lot of blood flow. This can be a concern in terms of keeping all that heat stuck inside the middle part of the body and not letting it come out to the outer parts, and can be a contributor to blood pressure being too high. So if you see this kind of pattern, you know, A, it's worth, you know, getting in touch with your physician and just making sure that your blood pressure is okay. And if it's not, one of the best solutions is to use herbs that have traditionally been employed for breaking the fever or for getting people to sweat. And the reason you use these is because they open that peripheral circulation up dramatically and substantially. And so they kind of equalize the balance of heat, so it's not trapped in the core anymore and kind of burdening the heart. They also dilate the blood vessels, right? So the tube is wider. And as a result, you have better pressure at the core because now you have a wider pipe in the arms and in the legs. More blood can flow there, and so it's not all trapped in the core again, burdening the heart and raising the pressure. So some of these herbs include things like elderflower, but also yarrow, one of my favorites, and yarrow actually has clinical research behind it for hypertension, a trial that came out in the early years of the 2000s. You know, people taking just yarrow by itself for 3 to 4 months saw a dramatic, you know, I would say on the order of 15 to 20 points drop in their blood pressures, systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure levels. And this can be huge if someone comes in, you know, is 145 over 95 and the doctor wants to get them on a blood pressure medication. You can try yarrow tea or an extract of yarrow, and after a couple months check again, and you can be pretty sure that the blood pressure will be a little lower. Another herb that opens the circulation up really well is garlic, right? You know, if you take a lot of raw garlic and you eat too much of it, it's going to make you kind of almost perspire and definitely make you feel warmer. Garlic is another herb that has been connected with lower blood pressure levels and an improvement in circulation to the hands and the feet and the arms and the legs. So again, it's this idea of opening up circulation so that all that blood isn't in the middle of the body, putting the burden on the heart and increasing the blood pressure.
So interesting. I have that. And nobody has ever, they always try to tell me that it's my hormones or this or that, but I'm so glad to hear that.
Eva, the reason why that happens is a little bit more of a mystery, right? It varies from person to person. But you can reliably open that up with these herbs that have you know, this warming and circulatory enhancing quality, like yarrow or garlic or even ginger to a certain extent, right? If people like the flavor of ginger tea. If you're dealing with anything having to do with the heart, one of my most favorite herbs is hawthorn, because the berry, as well as the leaf and flower of hawthorn, are this sort of fantastic, fantastic regulators of heart function. So if the blood pressure is too low, you know, and one of the best ways to tell if your blood pressure is too low, and this hits people with folks who have low thyroid function, for instance, their blood pressure can be a little bit low. Sometimes, you know, you're just born with a lower blood pressure. One of the things you'll notice is if you get up out of bed too quickly, first thing in the morning, you'll feel dizzy or lightheaded. If you get up from sitting too quickly, you'll feel dizzy or lightheaded, and that's because the pressure isn't high enough to kind of push blood up to the head quickly enough to keep the brain functioning right. So, again, if you get these head rushes or feeling of lightheadedness or dizziness when you get up quickly, and you get them really often, first, again, make sure you're really well hydrated. That's really important. But secondly, if you are well hydrated, consider a little bit of hawthorn, because it doesn't just lower high blood pressure. It can bring up low blood pressure, too. Hawthorn is just, in general, a great cardiovascular tonic. The place where it's gotten the best research has been in later stages of heart disease, when the heart's already failing, right? And when the heart starts to fail, congestive heart failure, or dilated cardiomyopathy, what you'll notice is that people will have a hard time getting their energy up.
or they'll get really sort of winded quickly and easily when they climb up the stairs. And anytime the heart isn't working right, you'll notice that exertion becomes really difficult, and people will complain of feeling really low energy and getting winded really quickly and easily. You'll see it if, for example, a valve in the heart, like the mitral valve, isn't working right, and blood is spilling backwards when it's supposed to be moving into the aorta, into the rest of the body, right? So it can't get that good blood to the rest of the body. People say they feel winded, and they can't tolerate exercise, or they can't even climb upstairs like they used to be able to, and they can't walk for more than 5 minutes without, you know, really wanting to sit down and take a break. All of these symptoms are potentially symptoms of the heart is having a hard time in one way or another. And that's the place where Hawthorne has really found some of the most convincing clinical research. It's in Europe used as a first line for congestive heart failure when people are experiencing shortness of breath and exercise intolerance, and it's affecting their quality of life. It really improves the symptoms. It makes people able to better do all those things like carry the bags of groceries or walk up and down the stairs. Strengthens the heart reliably, and it does so extremely safely, and you can take it alongside conventional medication. Again, this has been researched clinically. It does not interfere with the action of blood pressure drugs or the action of rhythm normalizers or anything that might be prescribed like a diuretic for high blood pressure or for heart failure. So Hawthorne Berry.
What kind of plant is it? It's not a bitter, is it? What is it?
Hawthorne is a relative of the apple tree. So it's in the Rosaceae family, and it's a short tree. It rarely gets much more than, you know, 20 feet tall. Big, long thorns on it. Yeah, there are some native species in the northwest and in the southeast of the United States, and many, many native species sort of all through Europe. And it makes these berries that are about the size of a, you know, sometimes they get as big as a crab apple, but most of the time they're smaller, about the size of a large pea. And they're red, and they taste pretty good, and you can make jam out of them. Or you can even use the leaf and flowers during the month of May, to make a tea. So it's a tree that we employ for its medicine. When we're talking about the hawthorn, we're talking about a tree.
Excellent. Thank you.
So further in talking about cardiovascular disease, one of the places that we really get concerned is in the level of inflammation in the inside of the blood vessels. There's a range of tests that physicians will conduct now that are way more sensitive than just the old cholesterol test, which we're starting to see is not really necessarily a good predictor of sort of cardiovascular risk. They look at C-reactive protein, and they look at homocysteine, both of which are markers of inflammation. And you can get these pretty cheaply now. You know, if you go into your doctor and you're like, "Oh, doc, how's my heart health? I've heard about this C-reactive protein and homocysteine test that look at the level of inflammation in the blood vessels. And, you know, if your cholesterol is high and the C-reactive protein and homocysteine tests are high, then you can be pretty sure that you've got a decent amount of inflammation and potentially plaque formation in your blood vessels." And, of course, this leads to all sorts of problems, you know, from narrowing of the arteries that bring blood to the heart, narrowing of the arteries that bring blood to the brain, narrowing of the arteries that bring blood to the kidneys and to sex organs, leading to a range of issues with all of those different organ systems. And our goal as herbalists is to help reduce the level of inflammation so that the plaques don't get bigger. You know, it's really hard to get rid of them once they're there, but you can kind of slow the process down and, you know, increase the level of health in the person thereby.
I would like to interject something real quick. One of the series that we did, one of the interviews in this series was Atherotech, A-T-H-E-R-O-T-E-C-H. They do one of the best cutting-edge tests for early detection of heart disease that you can find. Mm. So go back and listen to that interview to my audience. It was 3 or 4 weeks ago.
I
didn't mean.
So Eva, I would bet that what they're looking for is markers of inflammation in the vasculature, which you can see really subtly before any sort of big damage starts happening, right? So one way to do it is just wait until the damage is so intense that, you know, you go to shovel your driveway or you go to, you know, like do some physically demanding work, and bam, you have a heart attack because everything is so blocked up that the heart can't get enough blood to it. That's, you know, not an ideal situation to wait that long. Then you can get, you know, a little bit further and kind of say, like, well, what's my blood pressure and what's my cholesterol like? But by the time all of that stuff gets out of whack, you probably have a decent amount of occlusion and plaque formation anyway. So the sensitive test...
They do all of those early markers, though, just so you know, all of them.
Like homocysteine and C-reactive protein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
absolutely.
Others.
Yeah.
If I'd have listened to this test years ago when I first got it, I'd have never had a heart attack.
And that's
but
the hope, right? And again...
I didn't realize... I mean, it was cutting edge when I first did it, and I didn't realize the goal that I had in my hand. So I'm
the
sorry, go
two,
ahead.
Oh, no. The point, too, Eva, is that if you use the herbs earlier, you end up with much better results overall. I mean, hawthorn is decent for late-stage heart failure, but it's not going to turn that heart failure around. But if you start taking it at the very beginning, when some of these subtle markers, like the homocysteine, are starting to creep up in your system, then you can actually prevent the plaques from forming and really, you know, forestall atherosclerosis and cardiovascular damage before it ever starts. So, again, when we're talking about maintaining the health of the small vessels and the arteries in the body and keeping the level of inflammation down, really neat. We particularly look at bioflavonoid-rich berries. So this includes blueberries, but also bilberries and currants and cranberries. Blueberries are some of the best researched, but cranberries have some neat and exciting research coming out too. All of these bioflavonoid-rich berries, anthocyanidin-rich berries, have a couple of functions on the vasculature. You know, first of all, it's best to consume the chemicals that they contain in the whole food form. You absorb them better, more of it gets into your bloodstream, and they persist in the bloodstream longer.
Well,
secondly,
now I have a question.
Yeah?
Sorry, I just got to understand this. Most people who have early heart disease also have early diabetes. So will the sugar in the berries hurt? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about type 2 diabetes, the sugar in my recommendation is usually half a cup of frozen blueberries a day. And there's so much fiber in those blueberries that the sugar actually is virtually negligible. You may know about, you know, how diabetics look at the overall glycemic load of a food, not just the sheer amount of sugars that's present, but basically how quickly does that sugar get into the bloodstream and how high does the blood sugar spike? Because that's the issue, right? How high is your sugar in the bloodstream? And with blueberries, the sugar barely budges at all because there's so much fiber in them and, relatively speaking, so few sugars that they actually end up being a safe and for some of my diabetic patients, a really welcome treat. That taste somewhat sweet. You can put them into a smoothie. You can put them in a smoothie with some dandelion greens and add a little bit of, you know, unsweetened almond milk or even just water and almonds, and you make something that actually tastes kind of sweet, satisfies the sweet tooth, but has no issue in terms of raising your blood sugar and being contraindicated for diabetes. So it's true, and it kind of goes the other way around, right? It's like if someone has diabetes, then their heart becomes, and their blood vessels get hammered by those high levels of sugar that they start to experience in their bloodstream, because sugar itself damages the vessels, right? So the number one reason that diabetic patients die is from cardiovascular disease. The second reason is kidney failure, because, again, all that sugar damages the blood vessels in the kidneys. So, again, protecting those vessels is really, really important. But, no, I think it's very safe to eat, again, that quarter to half cup of frozen blueberries a day, or your unsweetened bilberry jam, your unsweetened cranberry juice, that kind of stuff.
What about blackberries, raspberries, and strawberries? Are they okay too or not?
The strawberries are not as good. They're much, they have fewer anthocyanidins and the sort of anti-inflammatory vascular protective chemicals in them, and more sugars. But the blackberries and raspberries, fantastic. All that stuff is really good. Yeah, and you can just pick them and eat them fresh or freeze them. The freezing process actually makes them more bioavailable because it kind of breaks up the cell wall a little bit, and you can get all those good chemicals, all that, those good cardioprotective compounds right into your system.
Okay, thank you.
So when you absorb them into your bloodstream, they sort of have a 1-2 punch on the blood vessels in terms of protecting them. There's this inner layer inside our blood vessels that kind of lines the inside of the blood vessels. It's called the endothelial surface layer, and it's this network of proteins that kind of
is a first line of protection, kind of like skin is our protection to the outside world. And so if there's an inflammatory chemical, a free radical, any kind of substance that might damage the blood vessel, the endothelial surface layer spans between it and the actual blood vessel cells. So making sure that that's as thick and as fluffy and as solid as possible is really important. And that's one of the things that not only blueberry and bilberry and raspberries and blackberries do, but also the hawthorn berry does. It enhances the thickness and integrity of the endothelial surface layer. But then once those compounds are absorbed into the actual cells that line the blood vessels, they modify the epigenetics, making those cells much less likely to become inflamed, secrete inflammatory compounds, or participate in an inflammatory reaction. So you can't mess them up or hurt them quite as easily. And this is really important if, let's say, you're diabetic or you're just a human being walking around and eating food in 21st century America, right? You've got a lot of compounds in your blood vessels, in your bloodstream, whether it be the high sugar or the pesticides or, you know, the chemical processing residues that are in your food that are potentially really irritating to your blood vessels. When the blood vessel gets irritated, then in the inflammation causes the formation or contributes to the formation of these plaques. And so forestalling that by keeping a thick endothelial surface layer and by ensuring that the cells are not as inflamed and not participating in the inflammatory reaction as much is a great way to kind of keep everything healthy and strong for the long term. So, you know, in terms of summing up some of the herbs that would be really good for cardiovascular health, I look particularly at the bioflavonoid-rich berries, and hawthorn is the number one, but blueberries and all the other berries are great too, maybe with the exception of strawberries. And then things that open the circulation, you know, to keep blood pressure under control, also really important. And these include garlic and ginger, but also herb like yarrow that traditionally has been used to open circulatory function. And now these trees are blooming up here right now. They probably bloomed a little earlier down by you, but usually right around, you know, the summer solstice, June 21st, the linden trees start blooming. American basswood is a close relative as well. And all of these, they make these lovely, fragrant flowers. One of the best things to help open up the circulation, and in Europe, sort of the number one place to start is a tea of linden for high blood pressure. And it tastes delicious. It's very, very, very safe, and is a great adjunct to just a gentle exercise and for helping to control blood pressure without medication. Now, one of the other areas where you can see kind of canary in the coal mine, let's say, for cardiovascular disease. It seems really important for the heart to be able to be in parasympathetic mode, in the sort of rest and digest mode, more than in the fight or flight or the sympathetic mode. And the longer you spend in fight or flight or sort of sympathetic mode, the more you see the heart begin to get more rigid, begin to suffer, and it can contribute to high blood pressure. And, you know, we all know that one of the best ways to get into fight or flight mode is to experience ongoing prolonged stress and not use your body to exercise that stress off, to blow that stress off through exercise. And a way that you can tell how sort of responsive and supple and sort of flexible your heart is to look at this thing called heart rate variability. And this is a really simple test that any of your listeners can do right now at home. And basically, if you can find your pulse on your wrist, your radial pulse, which is just under your thumb, laying your fingers, you know, on your wrist, just below where the thumb and the wrist meet, you feel that pulsation, and you take a big, deep in-breath, and you should really feel your pulse speeding up during that in-breath. And then you hold it for a second, and you blow it all out, you exhale, right? And when you exhale, you should feel that pulse slow right down. And then after another second or two, it kind of finds its normal middle of the range again. If your pulse does that, that's great. That's a sign that the heart is responding to breath, that it has flexibility, that the heart rate is variable and changing and moving. If it's not doing that, you're probably under stress, or it may be that your heart, you know, if maybe you're a little older and maybe you've experienced some cardiovascular issues already, it may be that your heart is just getting stiffer, quite literally stiffer. And it turns out that good heart rate variability is one of the best predictors of cardiovascular mortality
as people's heart rate variability decreases, as that sort of change in pulse decreases, then you find that people are at much greater risk for developing hardening of the arteries, for having a heart attack, for having a stroke or other cardiovascular event. Now, if you're under a lot of stress, you know, and you try and take your pulse, you'll notice that it doesn't vary. It doesn't respond to breath, as I described. But if it's doing that when you're, you know, relaxing at home with your family or, you know, when you first wake up in the morning, that would be something that would take me to the doctor's office and say, like, hey, doc, how about we run some of those diagnostic tests that you were just talking about, Eva, just to see what's up with my heart and blood vessels, because I'm noticing that I have poor heart rate variability, and that ends up being a little bit of a concern. But again, it turns out that some of the best herbs for adjusting that heart rate variability and improving it are herbs like yarrow and garlic, the herbs that have smells that are aromatic, that open the circulation and relax the heart. Another great herb for that purpose that I use a lot is called motherwort, Leonurus cardiaca, and cardiaca, cardiac, right? It's in its Latin name. It's been known for thousands of years that this has been a good plant for cardiovascular disease to help keep the heart flexible, help keep the heart supple. So you might make a tea or you might get an extract for someone that has some yarrow and some motherwort and some hawthorn in it. And if you can get that into a person's body and increase their consumption of particularly the colored berries like blueberries, then you'll be doing really good things for their heart health, I think, overall. So that's a couple of things around cardiovascular disease and helping to reduce inflammation in the blood vessels, forestall atherosclerosis, improve heart rate variability, and also some things to kind of look for, you know, that trapped heat idea and that idea of poor heart rate variability. Two pretty simple things that folks can check out and might be canaries in the coal mine for cardiovascular disease.
So if you do those... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
If you do those things for... I'm hot all of the time, all my life, ever since I was a little kid. Always hot, always hot. So if I do that, will I not be hot anymore? Will I get better?
If you consistently drink things like linden tea and you take yarrow, for instance, as a tincture, then yeah, it should make you feel subjectively a little cooler, especially not as
so
hot
happy.
In your core, not as hot in your core.
That makes me so happy. Thank you.
This whole
show was worth it just for me to find that out.
So the next thing that ends up being pretty important for a lot of Americans is their relationship to blood sugar, right, and diabetes. And it turns out that the digestion and the liver play a really important role here as well. Our relationship to sugar is really complex, right? It's a very addictive substance. The food industry knows this. It markets super addictive sugary foods to us because it knows it'll keep us coming back. It's kind of like peddling drugs, you know? And it works because there's this hardwired drug-like response that the human being expresses when it tastes sugar. So I always tell my clients, you know, they come in and they're like, I know I should eat less sugar, and my doctor tells me I'm starting to get high blood sugar and might be developing prediabetes, but it's just so hard to do. I understand you. I feel the same way. Asking people to quit sugar cold turkey is kind of like asking, you know, a heroin user to quit heroin cold turkey. We wouldn't ask them to do that. We wouldn't even ask a smoker to do that. You know, we'd try and give them support. There's a whole range of different things that can be done to help people detox from drugs. We should approach sugar toxicity in a similar way. And one of the best things I've found to help regulate blood sugar and help control our sugar cravings and buffer the effects of eating sugar are these bitter herbs, in particular bitter roots. And I want to briefly talk about them a little bit. But first of all, how do you know, you know, how do you know you should go to the doctor concerned about blood sugar? Some of the early warning signs of potentially going down the road of diabetes, first of all, is weight gain. And, you know, excessive weight can contribute to insulin resistance because fat cells are very hormonally active, and they secrete a range of substances that mess up our body's ability to be adequately sensitive to insulin. But that doesn't, you know, that's not necessarily the whole story. There are definitely people who are, quote, unquote, overweight and are extremely healthy, extremely fit, and don't have any blood sugar problems. Conversely, there's people who would be called, you know, normal weight who are going down the road of prediabetes because, you know, all they do is eat sweet sugary things. They just don't eat a lot of them, so they don't gain weight. But one of the things that I think is most
this sort of, at least on my radar, that I ask my clients when they come into the office if they haven't seen a doctor for a while is, do you get these low blood sugars? Do you get this, you know, mid-morning feeling of jittery and lightheaded and almost panicky and anxious that then gets better when you eat something sweet? An hour to an hour and a half to 2 hours after eating, especially, you know, a plate of pasta or something like that, do you feel this low in energy with, again, those mood changes and that jitteriness and maybe even a little sweating or something like that? All of those symptoms of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar can paradoxically indicate that you might be on the way towards prediabetes, particularly if you don't move around a lot and you eat a lot of refined carbohydrates, and maybe if you're a little bit overweight. And I'm not saying that having hypoglycemia in any way is sort of directly always connected to developing diabetes, but it might be one of these canaries in the coal mine that gets you into the doctor's office to say, like, hey, doc, maybe I should check my blood sugar. I've been experiencing hypoglycemia a lot. The reason for this is that, you know, to get low, to have that low blood sugar feeling, you have to have started from a high blood sugar place. And then the body compensates by secreting a ton of the hormone insulin to try and mop up that blood sugar and get it out of the bloodstream and into the cells. And sometimes it overshoots that target, and you develop this low blood sugar because now you've taken too much blood sugar out of your bloodstream and into your cells. And so, again, it's this roller coaster of blood sugar too high, blood sugar too low, blood sugar too high, blood sugar too low. Because, of course, what do we do when we feel this low blood sugar? We eat sugar. It's kind of almost instinctual and unconscious behavior. It makes total sense. But unfortunately, it gets your pancreas so out of whack that you end up developing a resistance to insulin, and your blood sugars just creep up slowly, 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 little by little. So one of the best ways to break that cycle is to use these bitter herbs. And one of my favorite places to start is sort of the gentlest and safest bitter herb is dandelion root. You just dig up dandelion roots, chop it up, roast it in a cast iron pan, chop it up pretty finely, and you can use it in your drip coffee maker. Cut your coffee grounds with it or use it as a substitute for coffee. You can use chicory root in the same way. And I think down south, you know, certainly in New Orleans, they still do chicory root, roast it in a cast iron pan, and mix it half and half with coffee. It's a really great way to control your blood sugar and also help digestion and liver function. But you can also take dandelion root or chicory root or both, chop them up and steep them in a liquor like vodka. And that basically is making an herbal tincture or a very crude herbal extract. And you can take, 30 to 45 drops of that, somewhere right around a quarter to a half teaspoon, before meals. And what you'll find is you'll eat less. It really helps control the appetite, and it's not because you're starving yourself or anything like that. You feel full more quickly when you consume something bitter before eating, and it really helps balance your blood sugar. One of my favorite pieces of clinical research on bitters was a group of folks. They put them in front of an all-you-can-eat buffet, right, and half of them got this sort of bitter dandelion root-like tasting substance. I think it was quinine that they were using, actually, on the tongue before putting them in front of this all-you-can-eat buffet. And then they said, like, okay, 15 minutes later, eat anything that you want, do, you know, take whatever you want, just keep track of what you ate, and then come back and report to us. And on average, the folks who got the bitter tasting before the all-you-can-eat buffet consumed 30% less. Not, again, because they were starving themselves, but simply because the bitter taste before eating makes you feel full more quickly. It primes your digestive function, it improves your liver function, and as a result can help balance out your blood sugars after a meal too. So you don't go for that second helping. You don't necessarily go for three slices of pie or five or six cookies after dinner. You're very satisfied with just one. And lastly, I use bitters. Yeah.
After, you know, I interviewed you a couple months ago, and you talked about that very same topic. So the next day I went to the store, and the first thing I did was bought dandelion tea bags. So I make that, and I love it, actually. I actually started digging it up in my yard here in the mountains. That's just so exciting. But anyway, when I drink the tea, it doesn't taste bitter to me, like I would think, like the greens do. So does the tea do just as good a job, even though it doesn't taste as bitter as the greens?
I think that the dandelion tea should ideally be the root. And the roots are going to taste more bitter than the greens.
Well, no, it is the root I'm using, but to me it doesn't taste really bitter. So even though it doesn't taste really bitter, is that still doing the job?
It's still doing the job. And, you know, Eva, you might have a special palate compared to some of my clients maybe because, you know, I'll give them a little piece of dandelion to try and they'll say it's the most bitter thing they've ever tasted, you know, but it's because they're not used to tasting anything bitter ever. And if you're used to having good bitter greens in your life and, you know, eating whole real foods with all of the fiber in the grain, then dandelion isn't going to taste real awful to you, but it's still going to be beneficial, right? The thing is that most Americans have never tasted anything bitter. And that's part of the problem, I think. That's part of the reason why we overeat is because we don't have anything bitter in our diet to sort of prime digestive function and help us realize when we're actually full.
Okay. And just so you know, we have about no more than 12 minutes left.
Yeah, I knew we were going to run short on time. It's sort of a broad topic.
You've done a great job, though.
So, I mean, beyond that, right, if you do actually know that your blood sugar is creeping into that dangerous range, if you've had a fasting blood glucose test and your doc is kind of, you know, raising his or her eyebrows and saying, like, well, this is pre-diabetes or, you know, I think this might be diabetes and we need to get you on a drug like metformin. There is a really excellent plant, an herb that comes to us from Ayurveda, which is the herbal medical tradition from India, and that is bitter melon. And again, it's just incredibly bitter. And let me tell you, Eva, that if you were to taste that, you would have no doubt that it's bitter. It's one of the most bitter substances known. In India, they actually take it and pickle it and eat it as part of meals in chutneys. I don't know quite how they do that because it's pretty intense. But you can get an extract or even a capsule of bitter melon, and it is a fantastic controller of blood sugar. It's, you know, cinnamon is really good, fenugreek is really good, but bitter melon is fantastic for helping to control blood glucose, Mamordica charantia. And so that's something that, you know, if you're interested in trying for, you know, 3 months, which is typically a good run for trying to see if you can budge the blood glucose, and tell your doc, like, okay, I hear what you're saying, and I'm grateful for the information. You go try some bitter melon for 3 months, and then you test your blood sugar again. It will certainly be better, especially if you can add some movement into your life. You can add some bitter greens and some dandelion root tea into your life and help control your sugar consumption using those bitter plants, which I think is one of the biggest gifts that these bitters can give to us. Now, it goes a little further with bitters, right, because I would say, and here there's no sort of early detection required, digestive symptoms are digestive symptoms, and people experience them all the time, you know, heartburn, cramping, and bloating, and gas, and all this stuff, you know, you feel it, it's there, you know it. Most people don't think twice about it, you know, like a little bit of gas, a little bit of constipation, whatever. But really, you should pay more attention to it, because the health of your gut really underpins a range of other potentially problematic issues in the body. You may have heard of leaky gut syndrome. It's this idea that, you know, the barrier between the gut and the blood vessels gets damaged, it gets irritated, it gets inflamed, and substances like gluten or, you know, even bacteria can get into the bloodstream from the GI tract and, again, contribute to inflammation. And they don't just contribute to cardiovascular disease. They can make you more susceptible to allergies or food sensitivities. Some people will even complain of headaches or brain fog associated with leaky gut syndrome. Because, again, all this stuff that should be in your gut, it should be on its way out of the body, is getting into your bloodstream instead. And it's causing all sorts of havoc, all sorts of drama, all sorts of irritation. And what bitters can do is they can really make sure that you break everything down completely, so that you don't have symptoms of fermentation and inflammation in your GI tract. So less gas, less irritation, less leaky gut. And as a result, all these systemic issues like allergies and hypersensitivities that we're starting to see more and more and more of, even skin diseases like eczema, right? People will come in and be like, I have that spring and fall hay fever and allergies, and they've been getting worse every year, and that I've got the skin rash now that I just can't seem to get rid of. And, man, my brain isn't working right, you know. Sometimes I'll have a day, especially after, you know, maybe I eat a bunch of processed food,
have a day where my brain just feels totally foggy and I can't concentrate at all. Well, these are all symptoms of that are potentially related to improper function in your gut, in your GI tract. And bitters can really have an amazing impact on that, and they can impact it really quickly. In Europe, a bitter like gentian root, which is sort of dandelion on steroids, way more bitter than dandelion root, but very effective.
What was the root?
It's called gentian. It's spelled G-E-N-T-I-A-N. And you can find it more and more around these parts now. But you don't have to do that. You can also use the leaves of artichoke. If you've ever grown artichoke, or thistles even, and you taste the leaf of the artichoke or the thistle, which are close cousins, it's very, very bitter stuff. If you're going to go out tasting thistle leaves, please make sure to cut off the spine and thorns first, because that plant can be pretty thorny. But again, that stuff can be chopped up and steeped in alcohol, or you can just eat little chunks of it as a bitter before meals. It primes digestive function. It improves the secretion of enzymes. You break everything down. It doesn't irritate your gut anymore. So the short-term benefit is no more symptoms of heartburn, no more symptoms of bloating, gas, and spasm, and cramping. But the long-term effects are less allergies, less inflammation, less hypersensitivities, fewer skin complaints. And bitters are used in Europe as first and foremost, you know, because they generally tend to eat pretty whole food. I mean, that's changing now, too, as the American diet gets exported. But generally, European diets are pretty good and whole. But they'll get symptoms of allergies and things like that. So they use the bitter herbs to improve digestive function. And crucially, what the bitters do is they stimulate the liver to clean out the blood better and secrete material from the bile into the bile and out of the body. And so bitters are fantastic for that as well. Now, as the liver cleans itself out, as it produces more bile, puts it in the gallbladder, and then the gallbladder puts it into the intestines, and it mixes with the fiber that you eat, and out it goes through the stool, the liver also experiences less inflammation, because all that stuff that might be irritating, just the same way it's irritating and damaging the blood vessels in cardiovascular disease, it's irritating and damaging the liver tissue, right? And what does the liver do as a result? Well, you know, the fat in the cell membrane that the liver cells are made of gets damaged, it turns rancid, and so the liver stores it up in little bubbles of rancid fat. And eventually there's more and more and more bubbles. You know, you drink a lot of alcohol every day, you start to develop more and more of this fatty infiltration in the liver. It's called fatty liver disease or steatohepatitis. If you don't do anything about it, eventually liver cells start to die and they start to get fibrous. And the livers, instead of being functional, gets replaced with scar tissue, and that's cirrhosis, right? So what are some of the signs and symptoms of that? Well, you know, in advanced stages, you start to see yellowing on the skin and yellowing in the eyes. But, you know, we don't want to wait until you start to get jaundiced, right? Some of the things that people will experience is nausea first thing in the morning, right? If you feel like you get up and it takes you 3 or 4 hours to really develop an appetite, well, you know, the liver is very active at night while we're sleeping. So if it's trying to process everything that we experienced from the previous day, and if it experiences a lot of sort of irritation and inflammation while it's trying to do work and all that stuff, then you're going to feel a little bit of backup of bile and a little bit of nausea in the morning. So if you consider, and I'm not saying, you know, not wanting breakfast first thing in the morning, it's if people actually will feel queasy or nauseous when they get up, and, you know, the thought of food almost makes them, you know, oh, sick and averse. If that's what you feel and you feel that consistently, and maybe you have some symptoms of allergies or skin complaints or digestive complaints too, and I think it would be a really good idea to use some of these stronger bitters, like the artichoke, the thistle, or the gentian, to pay a little attention to your liver. Now, one of the most famous thistles is milk thistle, particularly for liver function. And we actually don't use, people have used the leaf, but we use the seed of milk thistle to really help tonify the liver, reduce inflammation in the liver, and prevent or even reverse this fatty liver infiltration called steatohepatitis. The number of reasons why it can happen. Alcohol is perhaps the most common, but statin drugs can cause it, and sometimes it can just happen mysteriously, maybe from the consumption or exposure to some of the chemicals in our industrialized culture. So paying attention to the liver has a range of benefits beyond just the liver itself, reducing hypersensitivity, allergy, inflammation, and skin complaints in the body. So that, you know, bitter herbs
not only for blood sugar control and helping to control or even reverse initial symptoms of hypoglycemia or help control diabetes, but also really important to normalize symptoms in the gut and belly, and really useful for liver detoxification, gentle daily liver detox. And as a result, you can have a whole lot less in terms of drama on your skin and in your belly. And, you know, taking good care of your liver is really important, because if there is an issue with inflammation in the liver, it's going to spill over into the blood vessels and contribute to heart disease and vascular inflammation as well.
I think that's a wonderful place to stop and up. You are fabulous, Guido. Thank you so much for taking time to come on my show again. And if you don't mind, tell us one more time your book and where to find it and your website.
So I tried to summarize some of these important plants, how to use them and why to use them, in my book that's called The Wild Medicine Solution. My name is Guido Mazze, M-A-S-E, and it's available through Amazon and IndieBound.org. And then my website of my school and clinic, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, is VT Herb Center, that's H-E-R-B Center.org, and we're located up here in Montpelier, Vermont.
Thank you, Guido. You're fabulous. Thank you. And have a good night.
Again, I appreciate the opportunity, Eva. You have a good night, too.
Thank you.